All right, let's jump into a deep dive that takes us all the way to India. We're going to be looking at the Chardham Pilgrimage, a journey to four sites that are incredibly sacred to Hindus.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, like, what makes these specific places, I mean, we're talking Badrinath, Puri, Rameshwaram, and Dwarka, so significant?
Well, it's almost like they've created like a spiritual compass across the subcontinent. Each of the sites represents a different direction, and it's associated with a specific deity. And all of those deities play, an essential role in the Hindu cosmology. So you have Badrinath; it's nestled high in the Himalayas, and it's dedicated to Vishnu. You have Puri; it's on the eastern coast, and that one is linked to Jagannath, a form of Vishnu. And then we have Rameshwaram; it's way down south, and that's a site that's sacred to Shiva. And then finally, Dwarka, which is on the western coast, that's connected to Krishna, who is another avatar of Vishnu.
So it's really more than just going to the temples. It seems like it's kind of about experiencing the spiritual essence of India itself, almost like you traverse this vast and diverse landscape, right?
Yeah, exactly. It really is about that journey and the challenges that you face along the way and the devotion that you offer along the way. It's really like this, a physical and spiritual test connecting those pilgrims to the divine, through the land itself.
That's interesting. Now, our sources mentioned that the Chardham, as we know them, probably gained prominence during the Gupta period, which was a time of just like huge transitions in terms of religious practices in India. So what can you tell us about this period and its connection to the pilgrimage?
Yeah, so the Gupta era was like around the 4th to the 6th century CE, and it was just an incredible time of flourishing, across India. Think of like magnificent art and groundbreaking advancements in science and just a really vibrant cultural scene overall. It was also a time when you had Vedic Brahmanism with its focus on those elaborate rituals that were often performed by priests, and that was starting to give way to Puranic Hinduism. And that was just a more accessible form of Hinduism that emphasized personal devotion and, narratives and a broader pantheon of deities.
So how did the Chardham kind of fit into all of this?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. Think of the Puranas as these vast collections of myths and legends that became like, the bedrock of popular Hinduism. A lot of those narratives are directly connected to the Chardham, and they weave stories and deities into the landscape itself.
Right, like Rameshwaram, for example. I mean, I'm thinking about the story of Rama building that bridge to Sri Lanka to rescue his wife Sita, which is told in the epic Ramayana.
Exactly. The Ramayana is, it's a cornerstone of Puranic Hinduism, and it brings this whole other dimension to the pilgrimage by layering that epic narrative on top of that physical journey.
So it seems like the Guptas, by patronizing these Puranic stories, they kind of almost inadvertently helped solidify the Chardham pilgrimage as this really vital part of the evolving Hindu faith. And did this shift to a more accessible form of Hinduism, did that contribute to greater religious unity at the time, would you say?
It definitely played a role, I think. By incorporating those regional deities and emphasizing personal devotion, the Chardham pilgrimage offered this path to spiritual liberation that resonated with people, from all these different backgrounds. Imagine like pilgrims from all over India united in their devotion, all traversing these sacred sites. Their collective faith is like weaving this tapestry of religious unity across the entire land.
Yeah, that's some powerful imagery. Okay, so we've got this really fascinating connection between the Guptas and the rise of Puranic Hinduism and then the solidifying of the Chardham pilgrimage.
Yeah.
So what is the experience actually like for someone who's going on this journey? Let's start in the north with Badrinath in the Himalayas.
So you'd be trekking through these, these challenging mountain passes, and the air would be getting thinner with every step, You're surrounded by these breathtaking landscapes, they're stark but breathtaking. And you finally reach Badrinath, which is dedicated to Vishnu, and he's in his form as Badrinarayan. The temple is pretty simple,
Great.
but its location is absolutely awe-inspiring. It's nestled amongst these towering snow-capped peaks and glacial rivers.
And it seems like from the sources we've seen, this intense connection to the natural world is a really vital part of that experience of Badrinath.
Oh, absolutely. It's believed that Vishnu chose that spot, for its tranquility as a place to meditate undisturbed. And the pilgrims, they feel that sense of peace there and that closeness to the divine, and it's amplified by the raw power of the landscape all around them. It's not just about visiting a temple, it's about being fully immersed in this sacred space.
And then after Badrinath, our pilgrim would east towards the coast and to the very vibrant city of Puri, right?
Right.
What would they find there?
Yeah, so Puri offers this really stark contrast to that mountainous isolation of Badrinath. Here on the sun-drenched eastern coast, you know, the focus shifts to Jagannath, that form of Vishnu that's often depicted with these large round eyes and pretty abstract form.
I think it's interesting how even the deities themselves reflect the diversity of India, even within a single religion. Mm-hmm. You know, you have serene Vishnu in the Himalayas and this almost playful Jagannath on the coast.
Yeah, it is. It's a great observation. You know, each site embodies a different aspect of the divine, and it echoes those varied landscapes and those cultural nuances that you find across India.
Yeah.
And then that diversity continues as that pilgrim journeys south to Rameshwaram. It's an island that's connected to the mainland by a causeway.
Mm.
And it's here in this southernmost point of this sacred geography that we finally encounter Shiva.
Rameshwaram, with its connection to that epic tale of Rama, seems to embody the intertwining of geography and mythology and spirituality that really defines the Tirudhamma.
Exactly. The legend says that Rama, after rescuing Sita, he worshipped Shiva at Rameshwaram to atone for the sin of killing Ravana, who was a devout follower of Shiva. And that layer of narrative just adds this incredible depth to that whole pilgrimage experience, and it connects those pilgrims to the stories that have shaped Hindu belief for centuries.
So from the serenity of Badrinath, you know, high up, we've journeyed to the coast of Puri and now this legendary island of Rameshwaram. I'm ready to learn about that final destination, Dwarka. What awaits those pilgrims in this westernmost point of the Tirudham?
Well, Dwarka is a coastal city. It's just steeped in myth and history, and it's believed to have been the kingdom established by Krishna, you know, the charioteer, the trickster, the divine lover. For pilgrims, visiting Dwarka is like you're stepping into the pages of the Mahabharata, you know, the epic that tells about Krishna's life and his exploits.
You can almost feel like that ancient energy there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the echoes of all those stories. Okay, so we've kind of started to uncover that geographical and spiritual significance of each site, but how does this connect to the bigger picture, I guess? Why should this pilgrimage, this specific route across India, matter to someone who isn't Hindu?
That's a great question. You know, the Tirudham pilgrimage offers a glimpse into how geography and belief intertwine to create a shared sense of identity and community. And it reminds us that sacred spaces aren't just about religion. You know, they're about history and culture and the human need to connect to something larger than ourselves. And I think that's a pretty universal yearning.
Definitely. It's a story about the evolution of a religion, the power of narratives, and that deep connection between humans and the landscapes that they inhabit. I'm ready to dive a little deeper into the history and the cultural context surrounding these remarkable sites. Let's continue our journey.
Right.
We've been traveling with these pilgrims to the peaks of Badrinath, the coast of Puri, the island of Rameshwaram, and then the city of Dwarka. But let's step back for a second and explore the history and the cultural threads that are woven into this route.
It's a story that spans centuries, you know, and it reflects the interplay of faith and power and cultural shifts across India. And as we mentioned before, the Tirudham, like as we know them, likely gained prominence during a really significant religious and social change in India, the Gupta era.
Right, the Gupta era, often called a golden age in India. We talked about their role in the shift from Vedic Brahmanism to Puranic Hinduism, but I want to know more about the specifics of that. What made them distinct?
Well, you can think of Vedic Brahmanism as having its roots in the ancient Vedic texts.
Okay.
And it was largely centered on these elaborate rituals and sacrifices, usually performed by a priestly class.
Mm-hmm.
And access to the divine was, you know, mediated through those rituals.
Okay.
And knowledge of the Vedas was really key.
So it's kind of like an exclusive club?
Yeah, it's a good analogy.
With a specific set of rules and practices.
Exactly. Now, Puranic Hinduism, on the other hand, it opened the doors to a more, I guess you could say, personal and accessible experience with the divine. And it emphasized bhakti, which is devotion to a personal deity, along with, you know, the myths and the narratives that are in the Puranas.
The Puranas being those vast collections of stories and legends.
Exactly. They were like these storybooks, you know, filled with tales of gods and goddesses, heroes and demons, love and war.
Right.
and they were really accessible to everyone, not just that priestly class. And so instead of complex rituals, Puranic Hinduism kind of offered a path through personal devotion, chanting, and, you know, even just listening to the stories.
So would you say the Guptas, by patronizing these Puranic stories and promoting this more accessible form of Hinduism, played a role in making the Char Dham what it is today?
It's really hard to overstate their influence. They were masters at, like, cultural synthesis. They were skillfully weaving together these diverse elements into something cohesive. They supported the composition and the dissemination of the Puranas, and a lot of the narratives, as we talked about, are linked to the Char Dham. So they infused these sites with, you know, stories and characters that resonated with people for centuries.
So the pilgrimage almost became like a physical manifestation of the stories that they loved. So those pilgrims weren't just traveling to temples, but they were traveling through the landscapes that had been given meaning by the Puranas.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't just about the stories themselves, though. The Guptas also integrated elements of, you know, Vedic Brahmanism into this evolving religious landscape.
Yeah.
You know, they recognized how important continuity and tradition were.
Yeah.
So while they promoted this new, more accessible form of Hinduism, they made sure that it wasn't a complete break.
So like a balancing act.
Yeah.
Respecting the old but embracing the new. I wonder, do you think this helped create greater religious unity during their reign?
It's possible, yeah. By incorporating those diverse deities and emphasizing that personal devotion and acknowledging the Vedic roots, the Char Dham pilgrimage kind of offered this path to spiritual liberation that would have resonated with, you know, lots of different people.
Okay, so we've talked about the Guptas shaping the Char Dham, but I'm curious about how it evolved after that. I mean, didn't other rulers and dynasties have an impact on these sites too?
Oh, absolutely. The Char Dham have been shaped by, you know, centuries of Indian history,
yeah.
You know, with the ebb and flow of power and beliefs. Every dynasty, every ruler has kind of left their imprint on this sacred geography, which added to the richness of the pilgrimage.
And our sources mention the Mughals and the Marathas and even the British Raj.
Yeah.
How did all of these rulers who, you know, some follow different faiths, how did they engage with these Hindu pilgrimage sites?
Well, that's where the story gets even more interesting, right? So let's start with the Mughals, who ruled a good chunk of India from the 16th to the 18th centuries. Their approach was kind of surprisingly diverse.
Okay.
Really influenced by the personal beliefs of each emperor and their political strategies.
I mean, we've all heard of Akbar the Great.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was known for being tolerant of other religions.
Mm-hmm.
How did his reign affect the Char Dham?
Oh, Akbar was really an extraordinary figure. He really promoted dialogue between different faiths. He even tried to, like, create a syncretic religion that combined elements of Hinduism and Islam and other traditions.
Oh.
So under his rule, the Char Dham were generally left alone. And the records even show that he, like, granted land and resources to some Hindu temples, including some that were part of the pilgrimage.
That's pretty remarkable. So at least while Akbar was around, the Char Dham had a period of peace and maybe even some patronage.
Mm-hmm.
But not every Mughal emperor was like him, right?
That's true. Some, like Aurangzeb, were a lot more orthodox about Islam, and they had stricter policies about non-Islamic practices.
Yeah. So during his reign, there were taxes imposed on pilgrims, and there's even some evidence of some temples being destroyed.
So the Char Dham basically went through periods of both good and bad times under the Mughals.
Yeah.
It really depended on who was in charge at the time.
It really did, yeah.
So what happened after the Mughals?
Well, that's when some regional powers, like the Marathas, rose to prominence. And they were from Western and Central India, and they were staunch Hindus, and they actively supported the revival of Hindu practices.
Uh-huh.
So they would invest in renovating temples, they established new pilgrimage routes, and they gave land and support to Brahmins and other religious institutions.
So it seems like the Marathas were pretty important in revitalizing the Char Dham after the uncertainty under the Mughals.
Yeah.
What about when the British came in?
Right.
How did the Char Dham deal with colonial rule?
That's what we're going to discuss after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to our journey through India. We've looked at how spiritually significant the Char Dham are. We've delved into the history behind them and seen how resilient they've been through changing political landscapes.
Yeah.
Now we're stepping into British colonialism. How did the Char Dham make it through this period of huge change?
Well, the British, with their their focus on administration and control, they took a pretty pragmatic approach to the Char Dham. They realized right away that these pilgrimage sites were so culturally and religiously important to the Indian people that if they messed with those practices, it could lead to, you know, a lot of unrest.
So rather than try to get rid of the pilgrimage or change it, they kind of took a step back.
Exactly. Their main focus was on documenting and regulating the pilgrimage.
Okay.
So they did these big surveys, mapping out the routes, writing down all the customs and rituals. They even studied the architecture and history of the temples.
It sounds like they were treating the Char Dham like some kind of scholarly curiosity.
In some ways, yeah. The British were fascinated by India's ancient culture, and the Char Dham were like this treasure trove of information for them.
Right.
But it wasn't just for academic reasons.
Okay.
The documentation also had a practical purpose.
What do you mean?
Well, by learning all about the pilgrimage, the British could manage it better. They put in systems to keep pilgrims safe, they took steps to prevent diseases from spreading, and of course, they set up ways to collect taxes.
Ah, yes, that ever-present reality of being under colonial rule. So basically, the Char Dham became part of this big British administrative system.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They were studied, documented, regulated, and taxed, all while being allowed to remain these important religious and cultural centers.
It's amazing how these sites with their ancient traditions managed to survive and adapt through such crazy times.
It really shows their lasting spiritual power and how important they are to so many Hindus. And that brings us up to the post-colonial era. Since India gained independence in 1947, the Char Dham have seen a huge resurgence in popularity.
What caused that to happen?
There are a few reasons. Religious tourism has made these pilgrimages a lot easier for people from all backgrounds to get to, no matter how much money they have.
Okay.
Infrastructure has also improved with better roads and transportation. And then there's this growing interest in cultural heritage and this desire to, like, reconnect with one's roots.
It's incredible that these places have made it through centuries of change, through empires rising and falling, changes in religious fervor, even colonial rule. And they're still important centers of spirituality and culture.
It's a testament to how powerful they are and how they've been able to adapt to all the changes throughout history. The Char Dham are more than just temples. They represent what's at the heart of Hindu belief. They show how geography and spirituality are connected, and they demonstrate that human need to connect to something bigger than ourselves.
That's a really interesting thought. This whole deep dive has been an amazing journey. We've gone across India, explored ancient myths, historical transitions, and we've seen how faith and tradition can persevere through so much change.
It makes you think about the sacred spaces we have in our own lives, those places that mean something to us, and the journeys we take literally and metaphorically to connect with the deepest parts of who we are.
What a great way to wrap up our exploration. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Char Dham pilgrimage. Until next time, keep exploring.